The question was asked, how does one deal with children who say, Mom, Dad, you did giyur, you did tshuva, you chose your path in life. I want to choose mine. And Islam's the way for me, or whatever, atheism, whatever. I want to just share with you a few statistics and vantage points before we deal with the question. We have to appreciate what a potent question you really asked. The statistics show that a far higher percentage of children that grow up in a home where the parents are chozrim b'tshuva tend to become irreligious than a home where both parents are FFBs from birth. I think the claim that you made is the central claim, but I think we have to add a nuance which will help us also gain insight here. The major nuance that's relevant is the fact that a child grows up with grandparents who are non-observant or not Jewish, uncles who are non-observant or not Jewish, and a perspective that once upon a time, my dad was non-observant or not Jewish. And so, like it or not, in this child's mind, the two options exist. Whereas Aaron's correct, every person has to choose, meaning a person born Orthodox also has a choice whether to continue that path or not. But he's on the path. Everywhere he goes, he sees people on that path. And so, like it or not, he's being prodded along a path, which is basically pretty much the life he knows. He can break out of it. He has a choice whether to continue in it. But it's not the same as someone whose identity is with that question mark. A person who's born in a frum birth home feels like his identity is frum, and he has to decide, am I continuing it? Whereas a person who's born in a home where a parent did giyu or was chozer b'tshuva feels like his identity is composed of both. And then a person feels a much greater need to decide, which way am I going? So a person will say, well, I'll inculcate him with Jewish values, and I'll stress to him how much this is the truth and this is what I was looking for my whole life. That doesn't change it. You'd think it would change it, but it doesn't. Because in a very real sense, the child keeps thinking, ooh, I have two options. So that's point number one. There's point number two, which from a bird's eye view seems less important. From a realistic view, I'm not sure which is more important. And that is the question of the parent's stability throughout the child's life. It's not common that in a from birth home there are radical changes. The house sings the same Shabbos Miros. The house basically has the same custom, the same nusach, the same way of celebrating events, the same tunes for Pesach, etc. You come to a house where they're building things from scratch and there's nothing to fall back on. What tune am I going to sing for Tzur Mishelo? What tune seems simple, right? It's not so simple. Because when you keep changing, when you come to Shabbos and say, this Shabbos, let's do Chinese. So suddenly you're eating Shabbos with chopsticks. And then someone will say, you know, this isn't the traditional way to have a Shabbos meal. And then you retort, where in Halacha does it say you can't eat a Shabbos meal with chopsticks? You can win the argument. But the environment in the home is an environment of openness without tradition. Openness is fine, but there also has to be a sense of tradition. And one of the things that a person lacks when he's chozer b'tshuva or a ger is tradition. And then the children grow up with so much change. And the change stems from a desire to grow. An excellent desire that the parent has. But the parent doesn't grasp that this change is hurting the child. So the parent will say, I decided after daven v'sikin. Great. But what about the kid? Okay, so I'll go sit with him in shul. I have a friend who does that. Every Shabbos, he goes and davenes v'sikin, and then he realizes it's important to sit with the kid through davening, so he comes and sits next to them all of davening. You ever see anyone else do that? So you could look at it and say, that's amazing. You know, he's doing double time, yeah? He goes to shul first to daven, and then he goes to shul second time to be with his kids through shul. It is amazing, but it's also problematic. When you look around and you're in a shul and you see there's a norm here, and then you see he's not. His children also see that. And that's the second aspect, the second nuance, where it's not just a matter of you chose, so I'll choose. It's a matter of you didn't conform even after you chose. So you're not exactly like everyone. I'm also not going to be exactly like everyone. And there's a tremendous urge, a tremendous healthy urge within a chozer b'tshuva or a ger. There's a tremendous healthy urge for uniqueness, for identity, for doing what's right all the way through thick and thin. And that is the strength that brings a person into Judaism. But when a person enters, it's hard to recognize that there's a value in tradition. What happens is a person says, wait a second, why do things have to look this way? He's a newcomer and he has 1,000 questions. And the questions are legitimate. But then a person says, it's pretty boring. Everyone here wears white shirts on Shabbos. I'm going to go get a Giorgio Armani for $700 in honor of Shabbos. And it'll be black with nice, shiny, thick black stripes. And that's a fancy shirt for Shabbos. Those simple white shirts, that's not a shirt for Shabbos. Can you say he's wrong? A guy says, everyone here is wearing that simple black striped talis. I'm getting a colorful talis. I want to honor the mitzvah. Very nice. Everyone else takes a simple esrog. I'm getting a beautiful Yemenite esrog. And I can tell you all the reasons why Yemenite esrog is better. People use the same toothbrush for meat and milk. What's wrong with them? I'm going to be more pious. I'll have a meat toothbrush and a milk toothbrush. I go to the shower. They don't wear a yarmulke in the shower. I don't know how they could walk around without a yarmulke. I don't know. How could a person have those minutes? If you're a God-fearing person, doesn't it bother you? So I'm going to get my shower yarmulke. He's laughing. I don't know if he was here when I said this example the first time and heads were nodding. There are a bunch of guys here who were saying, yep, I do that.
Yeah, I think there's a few people here that wear tzitzit on the shower.
Yeah, wear what? Wear what? Tzitzit?
See, that's the problem with Mahon Meir. Things here aren't necessarily normal. go to Merkaz Arab, you won't see one. Now these are people who are killing themselves to learn Torah, you won't see one. I was in Merkaz Arab a decade. I used the showers there, never saw that. Not once. You're telling me in Machon Meir there's more than one? Okay, I'm sorry to hear that. Why would you do that? I didn't say it's asur. But there's normalcy. What Am Yisrael's doing is kosher. Let's live up to what Am Yisrael does. It's hard enough. And again, it's so hurtful to the education of a child when a child starts feeling like there's no norm. It's a question of how you find it to be most pious. There are 613 mitzvos out there. You know, how many people hear that the Rebbe of Chabad said it's not good to have your child play with defiled animals? So now they go through every book and cover and every toy that they want to get the child, and they won't get him a Winnie the Pooh because that's not a kosher animal, and they're not going to get him that, what's the name of that elephant who flapped his ears and
Dumbo
because he's not a kosher animal either. Now, Mickey Mouse, of course, that's not a kosher animal. I'm no fan of Mickey Mouse or Dumbo or Winnie the Pooh, but you understand, you're starting to rule out a million things. You can't bring anything home. Now, let's open the Torah. It doesn't say you can't let your child play with a Dumbo. It doesn't say that. On the contrary, it says that people did let their children play with all kinds of things, like ants and worms and who knows what else, live. And they weren't even kosher. So, big deal. So people make big issues of things that are irrelevant. I didn't say the Rebbe of Chabad didn't say it. I'm not saying there isn't a level of piety where someone can live that way. I'm saying here, what happens is a child grows up and he's given a handicap. Number one, he has within his identity that feeling that I am both. I am both Orthodox and not. I am both Jewish and not. A parent thinks that the gear ends with him. I'll tell you another example of this. When people make Aliyah, they come to Israel, and then they go to the pharmacy, and they see they're selling this little bottle of Gatorade for 10 shekel. And they look at that and say, you know, in the U.S., I'd get a gallon for a dollar. What's the kid hearing?
America's better.
Yeah. People tell me they're considering sending their kids to day camp in the U.S. What are you telling the kid? Why are people surprised afterwards that the kids get married and move out to America? Why should I grow up? Why should I live here? You brought me up with this feeling that here you pay a bundle for tricks and fruity pebbles, and in the U.S. it costs pennies, so why shouldn't I go pay pennies? So there's this aspect where by sharing with the children our past, we're making it part of theirs. By holding on to things from Chutz La'aretz, we're forcing our children to make Aliyah all over again. By bringing them up in an American environment here in Israel, we're putting them as Olim Chadashim instead of having them be born here. So then we take that example and take it back. Aaron, give me a few minutes. We'll get back to you. We got to take it back to the question of a person who's Ger or Chozer B'tshuva with regards to bringing up their kids. And the challenges revolve around a few points. Number one, we'll go in the order we discussed it, is the relationship with one's family. So here's a story that's happened many times in the last decade where students came from families that were missionaries. So their parents were not only not Orthodox Jews, they were pro-Christianity. So now the person either does tshuva or gir and they get married. The father wants to come down to the wedding. His father's a missionary. What happens when they make a bris and the parent wants to come down? What happens when the parent says, you know, I respect you, you respect me. What's wrong if I walk around with a necklace that has a cross on it? So the challenge begins when your children have to look at that. And your children start thinking, gee, I have two choices. Dad wears a mug in David, and Grandpa wears a cross. Okay. That sticks with the kid. We had a friend whose father had different girlfriends every week. And he'd come riding on his motorcycle. The man was in his 50s, had tattoos and wearing an earring. He barely had hair, like white hair left on his head. But he had a girl hanging off the motorcycle with him every time, a different girl. How do you bring up kids that way? The kids see, okay, dad and mom, they have a monogamous relationship, but there's another option. So it's true when the kid is 5 and 6, he doesn't have a Yetzer Hara yet, so it's like, that's funny. Is she my grandma now? And who's going to be my grandma next week? But what happens when the kid becomes 12 or 14 and 15? And his hormones start raging, and he'd very much like to live the life of Grandpa on the motorcycle with a different girlfriend every week. You're posing a huge challenge to the child. And here we come to part of the solution. So if we address aspect number one, so then with regard to aspect number one, the fact that the family ties still represent the other life, one has to think how to temper those ties. So one can tell his parents, you know, if you come here, Dad, I want you to wear a yarmulke. You have to decide which points are worth fighting over and which not. If you're going to buy toys or books for the kids. So I want us to go over which toys or books are toys that we let the kids have. And one of the major no-nos that people mess up on is you don't send your kids there. Bring them to your territory. This is a fight I've fought many times. Unfortunately, I can't say I've won it every time, but I can say that we've seen the outcome in a drastic way. Very often when a kid reaches the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, the parents feel like, let me send him for a week to his grandparents. Let him go explore France, Switzerland, California, Mexico. Let him have a good time. They're respectful of our way of life. They promise me they'll ensure I'll have kosher food. I'll send him with kosher food. What I've seen is that very often the kids never come back. Oh, physically they walk back. Spiritually, they're still there. They never make it back. It shakes their foundation. When they're exposed to that type of lifestyle, when they suddenly live it and they're given that warmth and that love, and it's so enticing. This is great. Wait a second. I didn't turn on the TV on Shabbos. They turned on the TV on Shabbos. I didn't go doing everything they did, but I sure saw it, and they seem to be having a great time. That's something that really shakes the foundation. So I think that if we're dealing with that challenge, one of the major points, which obviously we can't encompass, but one of the major points you have to think through is how you build that relationship with the rest of the family. You've moved on? Okay, so some of those people you'll take with you, some you'll leave behind. Those who you take with you, you have to figure out how you do it on your terms. I can tell you that this is something that almost on a weekly basis, I sit down with our alumni and we think through how to deal with challenge A or B or C. And usually we find compromises. Like the kid who doesn't let internet into his house. I say kid, he's already a parent to three kids. He doesn't let internet into his house. But when his parents come, they Baha'i it and they sit down and they're sitting with their iPhones. And to make matters worse, they show up and they give him and her a gift, an iPhone. Now, they've been begging them, please don't play with your iPhone in our house. And the parents don't hear it. So now he calls up and says, what do I do? They call me on a weekly basis, and part of the conversation is, are you using the iPhone I got you? So I told him, look, if this is the way you want to bring up your house, you don't have to fight them. Take the iPhone, put it away somewhere, you know, and when they call, he wanted to sell it. I said, I don't think that's right. I think that's going too far. You know, they got you a gift, even though it wasn't something you wanted. You don't have to destroy it. You don't have to get rid of it. You could tell them, you know, this isn't the type of thing that I have so much of a use for. And after a few weeks of telling them that, they'll eventually realize that you're not using it. They'll ask you, they will ask you, do you still have it? And you'll be able to truthfully say yes. The fact that you buried it with your Pesach dishes is irrelevant. For them, you have it. You don't have so much use for it. Fine. I'm saying there's a balanced way not to compromise on your ideals and at the same time to maintain a respectful relationship. Again, each scenario in its own right. Sometimes you have to sever ties. We had a student here whose grandmother came to visit and they had a great relationship and she begged him to just come with her as she took a tour of all the monasteries in the old cities. In the old city. And he always waited outside and she went inside. And she went to the tours and he went outside, she went inside. You know what? By the end of that tour, he was a different person. It affects a person. You know, he grew up with her. He himself used to pray there. Now, he just accompanied her. He just waited outside, she went inside. But even he walked away rattled. And I don't know if he ever landed from that. I'm saying we have to think in advance. We don't have to compromise on where we are. And we have to realize these aren't innocent things. These are things that affect us. They affect our families. One of our students wanted to take his wife to a trip to his parents. And his parents were missionaries. And I opposed it. And I begged him. I said, go anywhere in the world. Don't go there. And he couldn't understand why. And I'll tell you why. Because she knew, theoretically, she married someone who once wasn't observant. But she never in her life imagined lying in a bed and looking up and seeing Jesus staring down at her. That she didn't imagine. When he takes her to his parents' house, he walks into the bedroom and there's a cross there over the bed. It doesn't matter that he's going to take it down and put it away. That's a shock she never had. And the same is true for the kids. You say, okay, we'll figure something out. It's not we'll figure something out. You're exposing the kids and you're forcing them to view themselves as a crossbreed. So that's point one. And when it comes to consistency, it's a very tough one because it runs against the strength of a chozer b'tshuva. Again, the strength is that a person's an individualist and suddenly you're telling a person, conform. So we're not saying conform. We're saying be consistent. And within that consistency, learn to respect tradition and find the places where you can feel yourself existing as an individual and yet not make your kids feel like they stand out. At the end of the day, they're going to feel like they stand out even if you work hard at it. Imagine someone sneezes and you say Amen. You meant to say God bless you, Gesundheit, but you said Amen. So now everyone looks like, what did you just do? You know. And your kid's going to have to deal with that. When he tries to learn with you and you can't read Hebrew like the other kid's parents, he has to deal with it. When you sing Shabbos Mirrors and you don't do it like the other kid's parents, he has to deal with it. There are many things your kids will have to deal with even if you work very hard at this. So you should at least try not to give them more baggage to deal with. So those are the two major points, I think. If you focus on, you can help your kid and make it a smaller challenge. Now, what happens when the kid actually says, you know, you made your choice, I'm going to make mine? I think the reply has to be, you're 100% right. You have to make yours. And I hope you make the right one. Part of what you should give the kid as part of his heritage is an appreciation of why you feel this is the right path. But here I side with what Aaron said. I expect my kids to ask the same question. I expect them to be thinking adults and I expect them to ask questions and to rediscover and to analyze. And I wish them that they get the answers right. I want them to think it through. I want them to reach their conclusions. I would like to have given them the conclusions before they start questioning. I would like to have given them the tools and the angles where they can find it more easily, where they're not out there like, is there a God? Gee, I wonder. Hopefully, as a parent, you've given the child the tools and your belief system in a way he can respect it, value it, connect with it, and then use it when he's searching his own path. But he should search his own path. We want him to be a thinking adult. Okay? Maybe we should add one more point. Just food for thought. I have a friend who told me that when he and his brother reached the teenage years, their father adopted every leniency he could find. Because their father said, you know, the nature of children is to rebel when they hit the teenage years. If I'll continue being super stringent, they'll rebel and become super lenient. So he adopted every leniency he could find, and he's a big Talmud Chacham. And then both his children went off the rocker. They're both super machmir, every stringency they could do, they do. So only after they passed the teenage years did he reveal the secret that until they hit the teenage years, he was never so lenient, but it worked. You know, after they passed the teenage years, he went back to his normal way of life. I'm not saying that's the way to play the game. I'm saying there is food for thought in that as well. Meaning, what I'm really saying is that sometimes a chozer b'tshuva is too anxious that his children should be frum. And they push too hard for the children to be observant. And that also sometimes causes the kid to say, get out of here. I'm not doing this. Specifically because the chozer b'tshuva is so vehement and believes so strongly, that's sometimes why he squeezes the religion out of the kid. You know, the kid can't handle it. And they, with the best intentions, a parent can really smolder a child. So that's why I'm saying there's room for thought in that too. Yeah?
Just so basically, both my parents are wonderful, right? Or religious, and everything he said is 100% true. So, also just some examples of what he said was, I have a friend whose father is a gayer. So he's 100% Jewish. Just from the fact that his father would always talk about his whole life, and now he's so old and God, this whole thing, it's still made of doubt, because I'm ruined. So that definitely happens a lot. As well as in my own family, the thing about relatives, I have certain side of my family that's just like insane. None of them are religious. And when I was younger, nowadays my family is really associated with that. But when I was younger, it does stir up things. There's nothing. When you're around other people, like when you're around family like that, it doesn't make you start like questioning things a lot more. So
why don't we have a Christmas tree?
Yeah, something like that. Or even worse. So. Why do you
think it's drugs? We don't. 100%. 100%. You guys are laughing. 100%. You know, I never had the challenge of drugs. When I was in my last year of high school, my classmates were doing drugs. And they always said, this isn't for you. I didn't know what they were doing until later. Like, by then, I was already a frumie. Like, in my last year of high school. But don't know where I would have been if I did. Yeah, it's 100%. It's not an exaggeration, sure. Yeah.
Is there a way to like inoculate children against certain issues like this? I don't mean like a physical thing, but like an act, like these concepts or ideas. You know, like,
could you define the word inoculate?
Like literally.
Sorry, excuse the ignorance.
Like in the, you know, like biologically, you'd inoculate someone against the disease. Like a little bit of a little bit of the disease. In a small way that their body builds an immunity to it. Like, so the same way with I inoculate them against science and Torah issues or something like that, or faith issues or things like that. Or even concepts like, see that guy, he's wearing blue, he's not as religious as us who wear white or vice versa or whatever, he's mixed up or he's a conformist and we're things like that. To not view the world in this way. To have like a much more open way, like children generally smart enough to understand this at 5, 6,
I think you have to think,
or like that, you know, we start asking, you know, when the children do the parsha study or whatever, and only when they reach the age of like 13 or whatever, do I start saying, hey, you know what, you ever thought about, like, what's this, like, higher water, lower water thing, and, like, doesn't that make no sense, and, like, oh, you know, but actually it's, and then we give them that kind of explanation, or from very early on to bring up these issues before they would have, like, real mastery of concepts like this.
I don't know how to answer that question in less than half hour.
Why we have chopsticks and they don't, or vice versa, or whatever.
I think it's an important question. Is it shayach to remember it and start it next week? Even in Kochav Yaakov. Because I want to address it from a few different angles. Meaning there's a medrash that discusses this. According to the medrash, this is a mistake Moshe Rabbeinu made in his chinuch. I would rather address it at length. I'm concerned if we try to do a short answer, it'll be inaccurate. I don't know how accurate a long answer will be, but at least I stand the chance. So can you try to remember this for next week?
Well, no.
Okay. So let's try to start with this next week. Yeah.
Okay. Just on a footnote, a rough seagull eats with chopsticks on Shabbos. Anyways, I was wondering now, like, for example, if the wife...
I didn't know that. I wouldn't have given that example.
So if said this to the father...
But... I let's call a spade a spade. How many other people have you seen eating with chopsticks on Shabbos? So what's going to happen is the ger or the chozer b'tshuva is going to say, I saw him do that, so I'm going to do it too. It's not that you necessarily invent, it's you connect to the queer things.
I don't know,
it happens in every realm.
I don't mind eating with chopsticks, I'm not a fan of this.
I have no issue. That's not my point.
I know. What I wanted to say was, let's say... There are certain areas in the world where you could, even though you're a ger, you know, and you did some time in religious institutions, maybe you're a Baal Shiva, so maybe your Hebrew reading's not that hot, maybe your Zemiros are not like the most beautiful that you ever, you know, come up with. But like, you know, you can probably sort of pass off as a, you know, decent, religious, consistent Jew because just in your surroundings, so there's not that much else. So, not even so much in that, but in an environment where maybe your child doesn't have to necessarily sense the fact that you're a ger, if you can kind of just keep that out of the picture, maybe, is it better to not really advertise that across the kids?
Again, I can try to answer it in short. I'd rather answer it a longer answer. In a nutshell, I would say I don't think it's right to conceal such a significant part of who a person is. For most people, it is a significant part of who they are. At the same time, I don't think it should be stressed and mentioned often. I think it should be something I'm not embarrassed about, and yet it's not something I will keep repeating. Sometimes people say, you don't even appreciate it. I grew up without all of this, and you guys are so lucky. And it's one thing if you say it once. It's quite another thing if it's so much a part of the kid's life, then I think there's a balance there too. I think there are other aspects to the question, because then we have to discuss what about your history do you share with your kids and what not. So that's where it becomes a broader question, which is relevant not only to Ger, it's also Chozer B'Tshuva, and also in general. I have a relative who was the biggest troublemaker in school. And you're talking about he rode a motorcycle in high school through the classes. Like, they kicked him out of class, he went and got a motorcycle and started zooming through the hallways with the motorcycle. Talk about a big time troublemaker. I don't think he took a test without cheating. And he always made me promise. Like, he would tell me these stories before he got married. And after he got married and had kids, he would always tell me, don't say a word of that next to my kids. And all his kids soared scholastically. And I think he was very smart in that. That the kids only heard about his childhood being such a troublemaker after they were much older. You know, so that doesn't have to be a part of life. There are parts of our history that don't have to be on the table. I don't think your kids have to hear that you had 15 girlfriends before you met their mom. That's something which should stay off the table. It's none of their business. If it comes up when they're 18, 20, it's bad enough. But it's none of their business at that point. So there's a certain balance here. I don't think your kids have to hear a lot of the shtuyot that you did. My kids don't hear a lot of the shtuyot I did either. You know, I don't tell my kids that I doubted whether I'd be religious for many, many years of my life. You guys know that. I don't hide it. But I don't think it would be good for them to hear it at this stage of their lives. They'll reach the age of 15, 16, 17, we'll reconsider. At the age of 10, let's give them a foundation of clarity. From clarity, I can start questioning. But if I don't have clarity, then I don't have where to stand on. And that's the point which we'll discuss regarding your question, Bezat Hashem, next week, about how to give the kids steady footing and then open them up to analyzing and asking. But you have to go in that order. Or in the words of Rav Tzvi Yehuda, you first say, Ein kelokeinu, there's none like our God, before you come back and ask, Mi kelokeinu, who's like our God? It's a funny thing. You begin by making a declaration, then you ask the question, right, that's how education works. First teach them what's right, then teach them to start questioning. Whether they'll come back to the same conclusion or not is a good question. But you have to first give them steady footing. And that's where we'll have to expand, Bezat Hashem, next week. Tov!